This is the 10th program on my historical analysis of the present collapse of our economy. We have seen in recent history the collapse of two great economic theories, communism and capitalism, who were contending for the hearts and the minds of men. Each promised to lead us to a promised land, and each eventually failed in their attempt. It wasn't because they didn't have some element of truth in their systems that dealt with and satisfied some of our basic needs. Rather, it was because they each possessed only one half of the puzzle that has confounded human beings throughout the centuries. What do we really want? Order or freedom? Philosophers like Plato thought that these seemingly conflicting needs led to an eternal cycle in which, through stages, governments moved from the order and central control of dictatorship towards the freedom and lack of control of democracy and back to dictatorship. It seemed as though we couldn't find the right balance between these two contending needs. Dictatorships led to order without freedom, and democracy led to freedom without order. Will Durant, a historian, expressed the same view when he observed, after writing a multi-volume history of the world, that when freedom destroys order, the need for order will destroy freedom. In essence, he was saying that our need for order was more basic and essential than our need for freedom, and if one had to be sacrificed, it would always be freedom. So to Patrick Henry's famous declaration, "Give me liberty or give me death," both Plato and Durant would smile and say, "You don't understand yourself or your fellow humans, because liberty or freedom is always a means to an end, never an end in itself." Like the thesis in the Hegelian dialectic, which represents order and stability, containing all the interconnected patterns that form our paradigm of reality that gives us security, and the antithesis, which represents freedom and change, containing new ideas and insights that can be either progressive or regressive, the aim is always towards the synthesis, in which the new is combined with the old to form a new thesis that restores and restabilizes our vision of the world. Thus, new ideas and situations are always threatening to destabilize our theory of reality, and we are always struggling to reorder it by blocking or synthesizing whatever is upsetting our order system. Like the body's attempt to restore homeostasis whenever its biological order is threatened, the mind attempts to do the same. We might say that the thesis is the conservative principle, which is like Newton's first law of motion, which says, a body at rest will remain at rest until it is acted upon by an outside force. In other words, it is the role of the conservative thesis to defend the status quo or what is, and like a circle, it keeps repeating the same answers over and over again. On the other hand, the antithesis is the liberal principle, which is like Newton's second law of motion that says, a body in motion will remain in motion until it meets an opposing force, and its role is to change or develop the thesis by assuming a linear or progressive view. Thus, the conservative principle, because it will never move, leads to stagnation, and the liberal principle, because it will never stop pushing for change, leads to chaos and confusion. However, if, as Hegel observed, the truth is a union of opposites, then it is the synthesis, which is the moderate principle, that maintains the tension and balance between the two, and is then transformed into the new thesis. This being the case, we could observe that today's liberals are tomorrow's conservatives, because once the liberals gain access into the thesis, they immediately begin to oppose any change. Notice how quickly the freedom fighters of the liberal movements of the 1960s, who demanded the right to be free, became the agents and enforcers of political correctness in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Now that they were part of the new order, they opposed any attempt to change or modify it, even if it meant denying others the right to freely criticize it. The end is always order, and freedom is merely a means for reordering, never an end in itself. Thus, when the antithesis becomes a destructive rather than a constructive critic of the thesis through revolutionary rather than evolutionary means, it ultimately destroys itself through the counter forces it creates that seeks to reestablish order. Compare, for example, the American Revolution of 1776 that was more evolutionary than revolutionary with the French Revolution of 1789 that attempted to revolutionize the entire social fabric. The first resulted in a democratic republic, while the second ended in a reign of terror that resulted in Napoleon becoming an emperor with dictatorial powers to restore order. For as Durand observed, when freedom destroys order, the need for order will destroy freedom. So today we again are watching the eternal historical battle between the forces of order and the forces of freedom as communism and capitalism, totalitarian and democracy battle for the hearts and minds of men. According to us, communism represents the evil empire that would enslave the world, while we represent the forces of freedom that will free the world. And in recent history, we have been willing to fight wars and spend trillions of dollars to not only defend freedom, but to intervene in other countries to help them to establish it. Yet, according to our analysis, people really don't want to be free if it leads to the insecurity caused by chaos and confusion. Obviously, we need to better understand freedom and what role it plays in human survival. We might observe as a starting point that we need order to survive and freedom to develop, and thus we could paraphrase Will Durand's observation as, when development, which results from freedom, destroys survival, which results from order, the need for survival will destroy development. Thus, when the Roman Empire collapsed, Europe went through a period known as the Dark Ages, where survival took precedence over development. Everyone is talking about freedom as though it was the one thing that we couldn't live without, but from different perspectives. The capitalists are talking about economic freedom. Democracy is talking about political freedom. Communism is talking about freedom from class oppression. The church is talking about spiritual freedom. And the secular humanistic forces in this country have enshrined it through the word choice, as though choosing was all that mattered, independent of what you chose. In today's world, if you want to defeat an opponent, get freedom and equality on your side, and you automatically win, because since choice is what matters, and all choices are equal in a subjective world without objective standards, then who's to say that any choice is better than any other? In Plato's Republic, Socrates and others debated the nature of justice in government and concluded that next to tyranny, democracy is the worst form of government because the ignorant masses, who are often incapable of running their own lives, are certainly incapable of running the affairs of state. Government, as I have defined it in previous programs, is a social institution created by the logical left hemisphere of the brain for the purpose of making, judging, and enforcing laws that are necessary for social order and justice. That is its purpose, and that is the standard by which it is to be measured, whether it be a dictatorship, aristocracy, oligarchy, democracy, etc. The only significant difference between one form of government and another is who has the power to carry out the purpose and functions of government. It can be a king, a dictator, a nobility class, an oligarchy, or the people themselves, but they all must be judged by the same standard. In other words, all good governments make, judge, and enforce laws that establish social order and justice, or else they fail in their purpose. Thus, one cannot state before investigation that one form of government is necessarily better than another until they both have been measured against the purpose of a government. It is quite possible for an enlightened dictator to establish social order and justice better than an unenlightened democracy. However, according to Plato's Republic, all governments eventually fail because of the practice of nepotism, which is the appointment of incompetent relatives by those in control to important positions in the state. Thus, within the Republic, an outline is proposed for a form of government or state that would eliminate the problems of previous forms and lead to a just society that is led by its most enlightened members. This form has come to be known as a republic, and it is the form that was adopted by the United States, the Soviet Union, Communist China, and many other nations that overthrew kings or czars or emperors in modern times. But you might say, how can both the United States, which is democratic, have the same form of government as the Soviet Union and Communist China, who are non-democratic? To understand this, we have to define what a republic is by modifying my previous definition of government. A republic is a form of government created by the left hemisphere of the brain in which representatives of the people make, judge, and enforce laws that are necessary for social order and justice. The difference between our form of republican government and those of the communist nations is how those representatives are chosen. In a democratic republic, the people freely choose their representatives from among competing candidates. In other types, the representatives can be chosen by a different process. For example, let's look at the broad outline of the republican form of government suggested in Plato's Republic, which has been called by some a meritocracy, because everybody's position in it is determined by their merit. First of all, to combat nepotism, the destroyer of all good governments, all children will be removed from their parents at birth and raised by the state so that no one will know who their relatives are. Second, the children will be placed in a state-run educational program, signified by a triangle, in which each one will rise only as high as his or her merits will take them. They all begin at the base of the triangle, but as each reaches his or her full potential, they drop out to perform those tasks in society that are equal to their talents. Third, they will be educated according to an educational developmental plan that will begin with music for everyone and end with philosophy for those who survive the lower levels. Fourth, they will begin with music because, according to the Greeks, all music contains a spirit that could be wild, loving, peaceful, sinister, etc., that invades and trains their souls. Fifth, this will be followed by gymnastics, which trains their bodies. Sixth, after this, they will be taught skills such as reading, writing, and math that prepares them for assuming some role in the social body. As each one reaches his or her level of competency, they drop out of the system and assume their place in the social body, and the number left grows increasingly smaller. Seventh, those few that pass through the lower levels to reach the top of the triangle are destined to become philosopher kings, whose job it will be to represent the best interests of those below. They will be prohibited from marrying or owning property, and after spending 15 years with the common people to become aware of their needs, they will study philosophy, which is the pursuit of wisdom, to gain the wisdom to know how to rule wisely. Once again, let me remind you that the pursuit of wisdom from a Christian perspective is the pursuit of Jesus, the wisdom of God. Thus, in Plato's Republic, the representatives of the people have not been elected democratically by them. Rather, they have been selected through a competitive educational process based on merit and talent. And this, by the way, was the vision behind most of the republics that replaced the monarchs of Europe. These early republics were not intended to be democratic. Rather, in most cases, they were intended to give power to an elite educated class who, because of their superior education, knowledge, and training, were best qualified to make decisions for the best interests of the state. In the United States, Alexander Hamilton voiced this attitude when he said that the country should be ruled by the rich, the wise, and the good, and the assumption was that if you were rich, the other two naturally followed. Thus, if one reads carefully the original Constitution, he will discover that it was not their intent to create a democratic republic, since the president was elected by an electoral college composed of men appointed by the states who were assumed to be rich, wise, and good. In the Senate, the senators were appointed by state governments as ambassadors to the newly created federal government, because they too were assumed to be rich, wise, and good. While in the House of Representatives, they were voted for only by the people in the states who owned property who were also rich, wise, and good. The Supreme Court and federal judges were not elected either. They were appointed by the president to serve for life with the assent and approval of the Senate. The idea of the common man participating in the election of his representatives is something that evolved later on through the efforts of presidents like Jefferson and Jackson and constitutional amendments like the 15th and 17th Amendments that prevented discrimination in voting and provided for the direct elections of senators, respectively. Communist nations like Russia and China, who call themselves democratic republics, paid lip service to the idea of democracy by holding elections involving one party, the Communist Party. Therefore, you can choose between a communist or a communist. And in fairness, I should point out that the Catholic Church is not a democracy and was never intended to be one. In fact, the Church comes very close to being a living example of Plato's Republic. The bishops and cardinals of the Church, especially in past centuries, before universal free public education became common, represented the most highly educated people. In fact, entering the Church was one of the best paths to an education. And since a true religious vocation is the call to serve God, who is goodness itself, and they were trained in philosophy, which is the pursuit of wisdom, they should have been both good and wise. And since they did not marry and theoretically were expected to be limited in their worldly possessions, they were free to spend their lives as shepherds representing the interests of their flocks. Those that did were truly what the Republic meant by philosopher kings. Those that didn't were wolves in sheep's clothing, who betrayed God and the Church by fleecing the sheep for their own benefit instead of serving them as Christ had commanded. Such are the flaws when good theories move from the drawing board to reality and pass through the corrupted hearts of men. So what is wrong with the Republic's idea of having philosopher kings who are good and wise represent the best interests of the people who, because of their ignorance, don't even know what is best for themselves? Well, there are at least two objections. First, from a Christian perspective, God calls everyone to follow Jesus, who is divine wisdom, and he yearns for the day when his laws and rules, which are merely the expression of his wisdom, will not have to be taught, but rather will be written on the hearts of everyone. In other words, he yearns to save everyone by leading them out of the kingdom of mental darkness, the Gehenna or hell of the Old Testament, into the kingdom of mental light that is ruled by Jesus, the wisdom of God, who is the way, the truth, and the light. In fact, divine wisdom is the only way out of the mental darkness of Gehenna, for without it we are close to being mere animals ruled by our blind passions and instincts. By limiting wisdom to a select few philosopher kings, Plato's Republic short-circuits God's plan for the salvation of the human race because it provides for our physical needs while undermining our spiritual need to grow in wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. As Jesus warned, man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes forth from the mouth of God. And what is every word that comes forth from the mouth of God? Whenever God speaks, he speaks wisdom, which is the logos or logic that he used to create the universe and upon which its natural laws are based. And how did the ancient Hebrews refer to wisdom? They said it was the bread of life that fed the spirit and led to eternal life. And what did Jesus claim to be? He said, "I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall not hunger. He who believes in me shall not thirst. And unless you eat my body and drink my blood, you shall not have life within you. And I will raise you up on the last day." So we should be wary of people and systems that promise us the bread of earth while denying us the bread of life. Need I say more? The decision to follow wisdom leads to integration in life, which occurs whenever we interact with what is true and higher, and the failure to follow wisdom, which occurs whenever we interact with what is false and lower, leads to disintegration and death. And as Moses said, "Today I put before you life and death. Choose life." Are we listening? Are we beginning to understand why everything is falling apart? Are we ready to repent and reform? Or will we die because of our proud, hard hearts and love of ignorance? St. John asked the question, "Why does God condemn man?" And he answers his own question by saying, "Because the light of understanding came into the world and men love darkness or ignorance." This is the time to humble ourselves by recognizing that we are not the masters of the universe and that many so-called experts have been false shepherds who have led us down the path of destruction. It's time to get back to basics by rethinking our past actions and correcting the false premises upon which they were based. The time has come for all of us to grow up by putting aside our obsession with amusement, which means without thought, and dedicating ourselves to dealing with the real issues of life, and that is why I am making the effort to increase your knowledge and understanding of where we were, how we got to where we are, and where we should be going. Albert Einstein once said, "The world is a dangerous place to live, not because evil, don't do anything about it." He was merely reflecting the same sentiments of Edmund Burke, who said, "The only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for enough good people to do nothing." I can't promise that I have all the right answers to the questions of where we should be going, but I can certainly give you food for thought. So put down that beer, turn off that sitcom, put down that Walkman, stop reading that pulp magazine and admiring or trying to imitate those entertainment icons whose own lives are disasters. In other words, stop listening to the purveyors of intellectual fluff and let's get serious. Crunch time is here, and we can't afford to miss the great opportunity that God has placed before us to rebuild the world so that His kingdom will come on earth as it is in heaven. The world is about to be reorganized, and if we don't push for our own vision, we and our children will end up living in someone else's vision. When we were children, we needed parents to control and lead us. And when we were ignorant and uneducated, we needed wise leaders to control and lead us. But these were meant to be temporary conditions because, sooner or later, we and the whole human race had to grow up and assume responsibility for our own lives, because true freedom is self-control rather than no control. This does not mean that we will reject the guidance or rules of the parents and wise leaders who directed us when we were immature. No, if they were truly wise and good, we will continue to follow their directives. The only difference will be that we will internalize and take ownership of them through the rational acceptance of their wisdom. Then instead of seeing them as oppressive directives from the outside, we will see them as freely accepted internalized principles for wise living. The day we decide to follow wisdom will be the day that we will decide to follow Jesus. This, by the way, was the vision of Thomas Jefferson, who believed that the masses didn't have to remain asses if they were given an opportunity to be educated. He envisioned a society in which, because the common people possessed wisdom, there would be no reason for a paternalistic government to expand its power to rule over their lives. In other words, the government that governed least governed the best. The size and extent of parental or governmental power is directly related to the immaturity of the child or of the people. And if our current economic crisis proves anything, it is that we, as a people, have been very immature and unwise, and we're about to pay the price by surrendering our responsibilities to government agencies as the problems seem too large for us to handle ourselves. It appears that the Greeks were right when they made democracy, next to tyranny, the worst form of government, because when democracy fails, tyranny is the next step. And it appears that democracy has failed on two levels in our society, the political and the economic. The reason it has failed on the political level is because we have allowed our politicians to be elected on the absurd promise to tax us less and give us more. Only a person with a child's understanding could believe that. As the saying goes, in America, or for that matter anywhere else, there is no such thing as a free lunch. The money had to come from somewhere, and we are now discovering that they have been raiding the Social Security Trust Fund and borrowing so heavily from countries, such as China, that our survival is now tied into their willingness to lend. Adults who live in the real world should have known this. Only children who live in a fantasy world could believe that you can get something for nothing. As I mentioned before, capitalism, even more than our government, is the largest direct democracy in the world because it allows anyone who controls money through the purchase of goods and services to direct how the means of production will be used to produce the goods and services that a society needs and wants. How or on what we spend our money is a veritable mirror of our nation's soul, and the image is not very flattering. To illustrate the power and effect of this to my high school students, I would take out a $20 bill and pretend that I am about to make a purchase which, as we should all know, is how we vote in our economic democracy. The scene would unfold as follows. What's that? Michael Jackson has a new video? What's it called? Bad? He does what? He grabs himself where? Oh, man, I gotta see that. How much? $20. It's worth it. Give me one. Then I proceed to pretend that as I am leaving the store, a clergyman from my church approaches me asking for donations to help feed starving children in the third world. What's that? Starving children? Where? Oh, Africa, Asia, South America? Yeah, I'll make a donation. Here's a quarter. The point that I make with my students is that capitalism, which is an amoral system that has no guiding rationale except the making of profit, will accurately reflect the moral values, or lack of them, of the consumers. What I have just told the economy through the dispensing of my money is that Michael Jackson should get a $20 share of the raw material, workers, investment or tools, and managerial skills, while those involving and feeding starving children should get a 25-cent share. As a result, Jackson Enterprises will go first class in every area, while those feeding the starving children will have to be satisfied with volunteers, second-rate equipment and accommodations, and contributions. But what is even more significant is that a value judgment has just been registered, often without any awareness by the persons making it, because they don't understand or care about the impact of their economic choices. However, if they ever did, they might be shocked to discover what we, as a country, spend on alcohol, drugs, cigarettes, entertainment, cosmetic, toys, etc., in comparison to what we spend on essential social needs or the needs of others. In this we see the flaw that Plato's Republic saw in democracy, that is, the uneducated masses will always put their own private wants above the social needs of the society, and to the extent that political and economic leaders are beholden to them for their jobs or profit, they will influence the direction of the society in a negative way. However, the other side of the coin is also true. If the masses were educated and mature, they could bring about the opposite results. So what happens depends on the quality of the people themselves, and that is the role that Christians and other people of goodwill are called to play. They are supposed to be the salt of the earth, whose job it is to preserve what is good. But as Jesus said, if salt should lose its power, then what good is it except to be thrown away? Looking at our present conditions, it appears that either there isn't too much salt out there, or much of it has lost its power to prevent the corruption of society. And that is the challenge that we face now. Will we, the people, finally accept responsibility for our actions by repenting and reforming of our own contribution to the situation? Or will we allow our political leaders to excuse us as ignorant children who didn't know any better by placing the blame on others and promising, like benevolent parents, to take care of the problems themselves if we will only give them the power? Experience has shown that power has a corrupting influence on the humans who possess it, and absolute power has the ability to corrupt absolutely. Like the Hebrews in the desert, we have to decide whether to march forward to the freedom of the promised land or to return to the slavery of Egypt. Well, I see that my time is up.